o'clock, 6:10 p.m. on April 25th, 2011. Actually, just heading home right now. Had a fun day at work, and I almost had to stay late, so I'm glad I got out of there when I did. In fact, I was hoping to sneak out a little bit earlier, and right before I snuck out, somebody else came and asked me to do a little more work for myself. Anyway, it's always rough leaving work because I'm usually hungry by this time, and that's usually the make or break time as far as whether I'm going to stay late. So kind of sucks how I really don't know how late I'm going to be. And if I go in early, it seems I end up working late anyway. So unless I really do get into this, you know, unless I really do get into a pattern of going to work early and leaving early, or unless I get something out that requires me to leave early, you know, if I go back to school or if I join a, you know, play or something like that that requires me to leave at a certain time. Short of that, I'm going to be always asked to stay late. So it doesn't really bother me in general because I'm usually a late night person anyway. I don't like getting up early, so I don't really like the idea of going to work early if I don't have to. But it does also suck when I'm kind of have my head set on leaving at 5 or 6 and then I end up there till 8 or 9. Not always fun. So anyway, like I said before, of course, just happy to have a job and happy to make the money that I do because there's a lot of people that are struggling right now and it's hard, you know, because, you know, you try to be positive, but it could get worse and I could lose my job any day, so I got to appreciate it while I can. And not just because, you know, I may not be doing a good job at work, but, you know, purely because the economy is doing what it's doing and they have to cut back at work, and I just begin to suck it. Anyway, had a pretty good weekend. I came to my parents' house for Easter yesterday and hung out with my family for a good while. It was actually nice because we had a little conversation about politics and whatnot at my parents' house, and I can see where a lot of people can agree for the most part on stuff that I say. I have a brother-in-law who agrees a lot with what I would say, and then my sister are actually looking at getting a place in Panama because they believe that the economy is going to get worse here, and it was an easy chance for me to plug Atlas Shrugged. Oh, great, the rain's starting to come down. I hope this doesn't affect the recording too bad. But anyway, I plugged Atlas Shrugged a couple of times because people kept talking about government getting out of control, and I think several times they actually mentioned what if the people that run businesses end up leaving or, you know, face the line that they already will be. Good chance to plug Atlas Shrugged because that movie is exactly about that, that the government takes over too much and people decide, you know, instead of hanging around and getting screwed by the government, we might as well go and start our own little society, and that's exactly what happened. So, anyway, so, you know, it's always nice when your family agrees with you on something. You know, especially considering the fact that I live with my girlfriend, they don't agree with that. And the fact that I'm not married, don't have kids, they don't agree with that. So it's always nice when you can kind of agree with on something and not start an argument. Not that we really fight all that much, but it just kind of hit me as funny is that, you know, we can go back and forth and talk about stuff and agree for the most part about how the government's screwing things up. And some families, of course, that could tear things apart, but instead, you know, we have pretty good heads on our shoulders, so we understand what's going on. But, you know, I often do wonder about what my family would really think if they found out exactly what I believe. And, you know, even on the surface of it, you know, not just the deep stuff, but I mean, I'm talking just my thoughts about the military and government in general and, you know, welfare and stuff like that. My dad actually was in the military for 30 years and pretty much was forced to retire. That's as much as they let him work. He'd still be there right now, I know, if they would allow him to. But he's collecting a pension. He's also collecting Social Security. I have a couple of brothers who are, you know, using, to put it nicely, they are using the assistance of the state in order to ensure that they can afford to pay for their children's food and medicine and stuff like that. And I have another brother who actually works for the state, or works for, I don't know if it's federal or state, but he works for the government, and of course, receives a paycheck from them. So, those four right there, of course, would be not on my side if they heard what I thought about all those goings on. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that my siblings or my parents are bad people, obviously. They're not, you know. And there's a very fine line between, you know, I remember thinking about this years ago, and I went into Saks Fifth Avenue, and I would see a T-shirt on sale for $200, or not on sale, but, you know, for sale, I should say, for $200. And you look at it, and I'm just trying to figure out what makes this T-shirt worth $200. I mean, there's no gold on it. There's no, you know, diamonds. There's nothing that would make it. The T-shirt itself, the material, was no better than any T-shirt I could buy, you know, for $10 or, you know, even $50 if I really wanted to go crazy out with my money. But here it is at least four times the amount that it should be really anywhere else, and yet people are buying them. So obviously, Saks Fifth Avenue is still in business. I should say they were. That particular one did go out of business. They left. Used to have a shop downtown Portland, but they're gone now. But regardless, they were there, I think, for, you know, several decades. So it's not like it was just something that, you know, they just opened up and shut down. No, they were there for a long time. And this recession, of course, the depression, honestly, that we're in right now is, you know, worse than we've seen in many of our lifetimes. It's been, you know, 70 years since we've had it this bad in our country. And so I can understand. That's why they probably went out of business. But this would have been actually back in 2003, 2004 when I first saw these. And, you know, you're talking $2,500 for a suit, $200 for a T-shirt, $200 for a pair of jeans, that sort of thing. It was prevalent in Saks Fifth Avenue. It was not a rare occurrence. And I remember thinking to myself back then that, man, I can't believe these guys get away with selling T-shirts for this. But then as soon as I said that to myself, it hit me. I can't believe the people that are paying this. So then the question really becomes, who, quote-unquote, to blame? I mean, is it the person who sells the product for too much or the person who buys it for too much? And the very same thing could be said about government in general and, you know, handouts and stuff like that. Who's to blame? The people that receive the handouts or people that give it away? And ultimately, I do blame the government. I do blame politicians in particular, because it's not, the government isn't just some company. It's not just something. It's people who actually run it, who make these decisions. And of course, the politicians who pass laws that allow money to be spent on people who, quote unquote, need it, whether it be welfare, whether it be military, whether it be just, you know, public employees, whether it be whatever, you know, fill in any public employee position, and, you know that a government official fought tooth and nail to make sure that somebody would get that job so that they could have more votes in their district. That's exactly how it works. And so ultimately, I believe it comes down to the politicians and those pass laws who allow these sorts of things to happen. I don't really blame the people who get the job working for the government, or, you know, getting welfare or working for the military. Because when you think about it, it was actually sad, too. I was watching another TV show where a guy, it was a movie. It was Freakonomics, where they had proposed paying children to get good grades. And so they told the children, you get, I think it was $50 if you got straight C's or better. And one guy, one kid, actually, his mother said, hey, if you get straight C's or better, because he's actually a flunking student, if you get straight C's or better, I will double that. So you'll get $100 every quarter that you have straight C's or better. I went to high school. High school was not difficult. If you spend more than 5 minutes on your homework, you'll get through high school just fine. Now, of course, I was able to work the system pretty well. I understood the system, and I was blessed that my sister cared enough to teach me about reading, writing, and arithmetic before I even got to school. So I knew those things going into kindergarten, you know, as well beyond the other students, just because I had somebody in my family who cared. You know, a lot of kids, of course, don't have this. So I'm not trying to downplay that. There's definitely something to be said about that. But the point is, if you really give it more than 2 minutes worth of your time, you can pass high school. It's not that difficult. Anyway, so the kid needed straight C's or better in order to progress through, in order to get the $50. And they actually had showed two kids. They showed
that one, and then another one who wanted to get straight A's so that they could get a limo ride. So not only was this school district paying students to get straight C's or better, you got straight A's, you got a limo ride, and you got to drive around town in a limo saying, hey, look how great I am. All of it paid for, of course, by taxpayer dollars, and it was really just an experiment that one of the economists who wrote the book, Freakonomics, it was an economist and a journalist, the joint effort, but the economist who wrote the book and another economist basically got together, I believe it was in the Chicago School District, and they decided to do this. But it was sad because you would watch this guy who had the incentive to make $50 a quarter, which to a kid, you know, $50 is a lot. He's a, you know, ninth grader. And short of getting a job, he could have just got good grades like I did. And if I'd gotten paid $50, yeah, I'd definitely be getting good grades. And he couldn't do it. He just couldn't get it accomplished. And it was sad because at the very end, you hear him say, well, you know, it's all right. I'll just join the military. And I think I made a comment to my girlfriend when we were watching it, but you know, it really makes you wonder. Here you have this kid who's, in the back of his mind, he thinks, okay, I can just join the military if I need to in order to get a job, in order to get a life, in order to have some sort of productive, you know, means in life, in order to make money. And depending, of course, on what he does in the military, if he's just an infantry soldier, you could very well argue that he isn't productive. You could very well argue that he's actually detrimental to society because here he's going to another land and killing people. And when you look back at the history of the United States starting wars, we don't have a very good history. Every single war that you look at, there's a reason why we started it, and half of the ones that we started, we shouldn't even have been in. We actually allowed something bad to happen so that we could go to this other nation. In Vietnam, there was, I have to put in the notes, I can't remember the exact name of it, but there was a false flag operation that allowed us to get into Vietnam. World War II, there's speculation that FDR knew about Japan attacking and allowed it to happen. The thing that I think is very interesting about World War II is when you're taught it in school, this is one of those examples where you don't really get the whole story in school. When you're taught in school, you're told, oh yeah, they attacked Hawaii, and that's why we had to go after them. But then it's not until many years later that you realize Hawaii wasn't even a state until, I believe, 1948. It wasn't until years later that Hawaii was even part of the U.S. So here, Japan attacked, for all intents and purposes, a military base that we had, but it wasn't our state. It wasn't a part of the United States. Anyway, that's a side note, but it's just something to think about that, you know, when you hear about the history in school, everything seems to be kind of lined up just right, and, oh, well, we had to go to war. What else can you do? But then when you find out later, supposedly FDR had knowledge that Japan was going to attack. He allowed it to happen because he wanted to go to war. He believed that going to war would get us out of the Depression because he believed in the broken window fallacy, which is if you break a window, it's good for the economy because now you have to hire somebody to fix the window, and you have to hire the company to make the glass, and you have to hire the person to install the window, and everybody has a job throughout that whole process, right? But what it completely ignores is the fact that you're spending money. Like, if I go up to your house right now and I break your window, you're not going to jump for joy because you gave somebody a job. You're going to be pissed because you just lost that money that you were saving to buy, you know, a video game or whatever. Now you got to use that to replace a window. So the broken window fallacy is one that says destruction basically is good because it allows people to have jobs. And this is exactly what FDR believed in. He believed in giving people jobs just for the sake of having a job. Instead of just giving people welfare, he decided to put people to work and then give them welfare. And it wasn't even uncommon for people to literally dig holes and hire somebody else to fill them in. Completely waste of time, complete waste of money, and yet FDR believed that it was bringing our economy back. Why? It's the same thing as just saying, stay at home, don't work, and here's a check. Completely detrimental to the welfare of the society, to the economy, to all of those things. And yet, people to this day still believe it. They still believe that war is good because, hey, at least we have jobs, you know. I heard on a podcast today that Lockheed Martin, one of the military industrial complex, if you want to consider them that, but one of the producers of military weaponry, had a $1 trillion contract given to them by the U.S. Department of Defense. meaning the Department of Defense has said, we will spend $1 trillion with you building our weaponry. And it includes something like 2,500 jet fighter planes in addition to everything else. And it's just like, wow, $1 trillion was just signed away, saying the American people are going to pay $1 trillion over the next X number of years. Please build our machinery. That is just ridiculous to me, you know? Who has the right to tell somebody else that I am going to pay them money when I have nothing to do with it? I'm not part of that contract. But that's a whole other discussion. I won't get into that right now. But the point is, here you have this kid in the movie who says, oh, man, I can't do anything. He got straight Fs on his report card. Technically got straight E's, which really was weird to me, but they put a little note that said E equals failure. Like, if you call them E's, I mean, everywhere else I know they call them F's. But anyway, kid flunked out of every single class, was given the incentive to get C's and get paid for it, could not get a D even in one of his classes. And of course, you know, he's got no motivation. I think in the back of his mind, he just doesn't care. And, you know, I'm not going to get into the whole psychological thing of how to fix it. I'm just saying that he obviously doesn't care. He obviously didn't put forward the effort. He failed all of his classes. And the saddest part of it all, I think, was him saying, well, I'll just join the military. And how many students, how many young people join the military just because they figure I got nothing else going for me, and now they're shipped across the country, or across the world, I should say, and told to kill people, or told to, you know, secure this military base, or, you know, do whatever. And these guys are just doing it simply because they feel like they got nothing better to do with their lives. How many of those people never turn around? I mean, it's one thing if you do that, you go overseas, you come back, you get your butt kicked a little bit, and you're like, look, you know, that was a mistake, shouldn't have done it. You know, I learned my lesson, you know, kind of like dating the wrong girl or boy. You get out of a bad relationship, you say, look, learn my lesson, shouldn't have done that. Sometimes it takes you down with you, you know. Sometimes you get in that horrible relationship and life goes horribly wrong and it doesn't turn around, you know. Sometimes you go to those countries overseas and you never come back, you know, and it's just so tragic and devastating to think that there's so many people who are going overseas into these wars because they think they got nothing better going for them. And what does that say about our school system? I mean, I'm not trying to pick on them specifically, I'm just saying in general, you know, if you have one-on-one teaching, if your mother or your father teaches you at home and homeschools you, I highly doubt that there's half as many people that are at the end of their homeschooling session are going to say, you know, I'm just going to join the military. I don't care about this. I can't even imagine how many people that get one-on-one attention with education and actually learn something and actually feel, you know, that same sort of optimism and, you know, all those good feelings you get that I got when I was 5 years old and my sister was telling me, you know, how to read, write, how to do math. I remember I still have papers that I had when I was 4 or 5 years old where I would do my math and, you know, writing sentences and all those sorts of things. And there's so many people that don't even get that little bit of attention. They don't know what it feels like to actually feel smart, to actually, hey, I know what I'm talking about. And in this case, the guy was in the ninth grade. He's 14 years old. So here we go 9 years later, you know, past what I felt, and he still doesn't have that feeling. And the only thing he feels like he has left is to just go into the war. I mean, it's horribly tragic. But anyway, I'll finish it up for now, but I just wanted to mention, you know, it is nice. It's very difficult sometimes when you talk to people and, you know, you have to fight them with it. It's very nice when you get into a group of your peers, the people that actually believe the same thing you do. Like I said, though, you know, if my family knew exactly what I was thinking, if they heard all these podcasts and read everything that I wrote, then sure, they probably wouldn't be happy. And, you know, it's going to be interesting because I do plan someday of hopefully, you know, releasing a book. And if I do, you know, it'll be very interesting to see how my family feels about it. Probably going to have to do a lot of back, you know, a lot of two steps forward, one step back kind of thing, you know, just to show people. Because, you know, I hate when you read something and you think, man, this author's just arrogant, or, oh, man, he just doesn't see the other side of things. There's a lot of sides to this stuff. I mean, it's not black and white. Like I said, you can't just blame people for getting welfare when the government, I mean, look at taxes, for instance. You know, you get the situation where I, for instance, have paid all this into taxes and I know I'm not getting it back. I don't feel so bad if, you know, if I don't submit certain funds or if I say, oh, well, you know, if I'm going to do this, that the government's going to pay me, you know, like, for instance, my condo got $7,500 tax break on it. Which is a little unfair because if I had bought the condo 6 months later, I would have got $8,000 tax-free and never had to pay it back. But instead, I got $7,500, and they want me to pay it back. Whatever. Got 15 years to do it, so it's $500 a year. It's not a big deal. But it's the same idea that, you know, if I had gotten the $8,000 and I didn't pay it back, you still ask yourself, have I even paid $8,000 in taxes my whole life? I don't even know if I have. You know, but if I had, of course, if I was 40 years old and I've been paying taxes all my life and haven't really been using much of it, then I'd say, yeah, I deserve to get that $8,000 because I've paid in this all my life. And so you really can't blame somebody who's been paying into the system. Same thing with Social Security. You know, you see that amount coming out of your paycheck month after month after month, or I'm sorry, paycheck after paycheck, so biweekly, whenever you're getting paid. And if you see so much getting taken out of your paycheck, you just think, okay, when I hit 60, I better get paid back for the rest of my life. And that's really your goal. And I just don't see how that's going to happen. I mean, we're talking tens of trillions of dollars now have been promised to be paid in Social Security. And we just can't keep up with it because they're simply not getting as much money in as they're putting out. You know, it's a political thing, you know. When you can tell people, hey, I will pay, you know, not only for your retirement, but if you're disabled, I will pay if your children are disabled. If you're disabled, I'll also give money to your children. I think somebody who's getting money because his dad was disabled, I think his dad had diabetes, and he was getting more money from Social Security than he would have if he was working. So he quit his job and took the Social Security money, and what does that say? I mean, that really takes a productive person out of society, makes them unproductive, and then on top of all of that, instead of just sitting at home and not having a job and not being productive for society, you're actually leeching off of society because those who are productive have to pay for you to sit at home. So now we have people sitting at home getting Social Security, getting Medicare, getting all these other checks where they otherwise could be working. You know, I'm not talking about those who are honestly disabled. I'm not talking about those who are honestly, you know, 80 years old and can't find a job or whatever. I'm talking about people who are able to work but not willing. And that's the problem, is you cannot pay people to stay home. When they're able to work, they must be working. You need to be working. If you're able to work, you need to get up there and work. If you're disabled or whatever, you know, we can argue that till we're blue in the face, but there's just no arguing that if there's somebody who is able to work and is a productive and should be a productive member of society, they should not be not only unproductive but also leeching off of society. And that's what's going to drag us all down. Drag us all down to the pits and cause our money to implode, to be hyperinflated out of existence. It's a crazy world we got out there because, I mean, it's just so easy to promise to make payments to people who, you know, you want them to vote for you, so you promise, oh, I'll pay for Social Security, I'll pay for Medicare, I'll pay for disability, I'll do all this stuff. You get all those votes, and what's going to happen? You're going to have five people voting against it. You know, we have the situation here in Portland even. They want to extend the streetcar from downtown Portland to Lake Oswego, which for those not familiar with the area, I think it's about 20 miles away. It's a good little jaunt, but nonetheless, that's a $450 million project. Of course, that's what they're projecting. They're probably going to end up spending more than that. And, of course, in the real market, it would probably cost you $100 million. I mean, I'm not even joking. In a free market, if a business was actually going to create it, it would cost them $100 million or less. I guarantee you that. But, of course, it's the government. It's, you know, government contracts, it's, oh, I'm going to build something for the government, it's going to take me twice as long, it's going to cost me four times as much money. That's how it always works. It happens every time. Give me one example where that doesn't happen. You know, I'll never forget watching that thing on Jon Stewart's show where they were talking about the people who were protesting in Wisconsin over the teacher's pay or whatever, you know, deducting the teacher's pay or shortening it. And they had a little protest, so they had thousands of people all protesting at City Hall. And supposedly the people were taping up signs on, oh, you know, let's coordinate over here, let's move over here, whatever. And people were using duct tape supposedly to tape these signs up on the posts. And they said, oh, it's going to cost $7 million to clean up all the tape residue. I'm like, what? And, of course, the way they spliced it together, you saw like 12 different news pundits all saying the same thing. So, you know, it's not just one person made up this number. Every single person was repeating that same number. And then like a week later, and they actually had spliced this all together, so it was all part of one segment. But then, you know, sometime later, you see somebody say, oh, actually, it's just been reduced to, you know, $250,000 instead of $7 million. And I'm thinking the whole time, why is it even $250,000? You could repaint the entire building for $10,000. You know, hell, I mean, you could hire me, and I could do it for $5,000. You know what I mean? It's like, just insane. This idea that it would even cost nearly that much money. It is ridiculous. And all it shows is just how much money people waste. It just shows how when government is involved, there's no such thing as a budget anymore. There's no such thing as, oh, we really have a limit on what we can spend. It is, the sky is the limit. Imagine you're a contractor. Some guy comes to you and says, hey, I need you to build an addition to my, you know, building or whatever. Oh, okay, it's going to cost you $1 million. The same thing happens where a government official shows up and says, hey, we have the same building, same situation. We need to build the same sort of addition. How much are you going to cost? How much is it going to cost? Well, you realize if nobody else is bidding on that, you can double or triple or quadruple your price, and they're going to pay it. Because it's either through ignorance that the politician doesn't know, or because the politician happens to be a friend of yours. If you're friends with a politician, which if you're in construction, you probably are friends with politicians, you'll say, oh, yeah, hey, cheap as I can go is $4 million. You do it for $1 million for the private sector, $4 million for the government. Nobody blinks an eye. Because what is $4 million nowadays that the government's spending? It's nothing. It's so minuscule that if a government official would even hear me complain about $4 million, they would just laugh and say, we got a $3 trillion budget here. You know, we don't care about $4 million. And in retrospect, yeah, it really doesn't matter. I mean, when you compare a $3 trillion budget to, you know, $4 million being wasted, of course it means nothing. It's pennies compared to, you know, pennies on the dollar compared to what you really need to focus on. But, of course, they don't want to focus on the bad stuff. They don't want to focus on, hey, how are we going to cut military spending? How are we going to cut Social Security, Medicare, all the big entitlement programs? Now, they didn't even want to touch those as a 10-foot pole. So then even if you do start nitpicking at the smaller stuff, politicians don't want to cut any of it. Why? Because they know if I cut something, it's going to look bad, and I'm not going to get voted back in. That's what politics is all about. You've got to get voted back in. That's all you care about. Like, imagine wherever you happen to work, just imagine you had to do something that would, if you didn't do something, you'd lose your job. Of course you're going to do whatever it takes to keep your job. Nobody works their whole life to get to be president of the United States or to get into Congress in hopes of ruining their job, in hopes of, oh, hey, my job is to get to presidency so I can shut down all government, you know, businesses. Yeah, there's very few people that do that, but guess what? Nobody likes them because everybody else thinks that they're bad people. Everybody else points at them and says, oh, that's the guy right there that wants to get rid of Medicare and Social Security. Oh, he hates grandma. Oh, he wants grandpa to die. You know, and they'll say the most ridiculous things like that, and you'll say, what? What are you talking about? It has nothing to do with killing off grandma and grandpa. It has to do with, if you're in society, you need to be productive. If you can't be productive, there's charity. If you're in society and you can be productive. And see, this whole idea that in America especially, and I remember, I mean, I fell for the same thing myself. I remember going through college even, and I wrote in a paper about how, oh, everybody's dream is to retire when they're 60. And I can't remember exactly how my professor took it. He was a pretty harsh guy, though. He told you how it was, and he pretty much said, that's not true. Or he said, is it really, or whatever, you know. And I could tell when I reread it, I was like, wow, I mean, it hadn't even occurred to me. I mean, I just said it, I typed it out in my paper, and I submitted it to him, and I was rereading it, and I was like, wow, that's true. It's a very Americanized idea to think that you can work till you're 60, stop working, and live another 40 years without working ever again. I mean, you're talking, most countries, you work till you're 80 years old and you die, you know, and in some countries, once you get to a certain age, if you're no longer productive, they will literally take you out in the cold and let you die. They'll literally take you off somewhere and just let you die. And that's what their society believes in, is that if you're unproductive, you do not deserve to live. I'm not advocating for this whatsoever. I'm just telling you how it is. So for America to think that, hey, I'm 60 years old, I'm unproductive, I should live 40 more years. There's societies out there that will say, that's ridiculous. Why are you supporting people who are not willing to work? This is the kind of thing that Ayn Rand would talk about, where people would say, oh, you're just all about selfishness. Oh, you don't care about other people. All you have to do is care about yourself and your family. You know, if you have family and friends around you, great, care about them. But otherwise, all you have to do is worry about yourself. If everybody just worried about themselves, and like I said, if necessary, your family and friends, this world would be a much better place. Somebody comes up to me and says, hey, man, can I have a dollar? I'll say, I don't know who you are. Why do I need to give you a dollar? Go to your family and your friends. Get a job, or go to a charity where people want to give you a dollar. It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, when you really look at it in that perspective, it does not make any sense. If our society was built the way that Ayn Rand thought it should be, you know, you're born, 80, 90% of the people, right? You're born and you go through your entire life till you're 80 years old, you know, you can be productive at least until your 70s. 80 to 90% of the population can be born and raised and live in society, take care of their own. If you have children, take care of your children. And you can make it to 70 or 80 easily. The vast majority of the people, I'm not talking about half the people, I'm talking about the vast majority of the people are productive from the, I shouldn't say from the time they're born, but of course by the time they're 18, yeah. Your parents raise you, you turn 18, you get out of the house. Okay, from 18 to 70, you should be able to go out into the working world, find a job, do what you need to do. Of course, we all lose jobs, we all get great jobs, we all get crappy jobs, you know, a mix in between. Do what you need to do for that amount of time. If you've saved enough, if you've been smart, you can save and retire. If not, you keep working. If life gives you a curveball, you go to your family and friends for help. If they can't help you, there's a charity. Now, what's wrong with this picture? The problem really is that in our society, we have a situation where every single person depends on, you know, it's not, and I'm not just talking about economically and socially, like, oh, I depend on you because you you work at the grocery store and you provide food and I have to buy the food at the grocery store because I don't want to grow my own and I have to go to the mechanic because I have to get my car fixed and I can't fix my own car. I'm not talking about that. I think, you know, that's the division of labor and that's a great thing because you don't want to become an expert in all those things. You don't want to become an expert in law, in medicine, in finance, in agriculture, and in mechanics. And then have to do everything yourself. No, of course, you focus on one thing, you do good at one thing, you get a job working there, you make money, and then you spend that money on those who have expertise in agriculture, in medicine, in law, and in mechanics, and all the other things. So you focus on one thing, you do good on one thing, and you spend your money on everything else. So that's a way of, you know, ensuring that you have a car that runs, ensuring that you have food on your table, ensuring that you have, you know, healthy body and ensuring that you have legal support. You know, this is just an example, of course. There's any number of avenues to go. But in order to get all those things together, you focus on one thing, you make money, and you spend it on all the other. Now, when it comes to Ayn Rand, what she would talk about, you focus on that thing. If you lose your job, you get another job. But at no point during this whole process do you say, oh, I lost my job. Now you, Mr. Stranger Person, you owe me money. You need to pay for me to live here. You need to pay for me to go to work. Or you need to pay for me to, put food on my table. Or you need to provide this or you need to provide that. And Rainer would say, no. That is up to you. You are a human being. You have the ability to take care of yourself. You have the desire to take care of yourself. If you're suicidal and you want to kill yourself, that's one thing. If you're mentally challenged, if you're physically disabled, that's another thing. But if you are, like I said, 80 to 90% of the population, if you're of sound mind and you're able to go to work and you're able to provide, then you do so. It does not make any sense. In her world, it would not make any sense for me to go up to a stranger and say, oh, man, I'm, you know, I mean, short of maybe, you know, like if you're trying to catch a bus or something and you happen to be waiting in line with the guy at the bus stop. There's nothing to say that you can't be nice to people. But all I'm saying is this mentality that, you know, I should be able to go to the government and I tell the government I can't afford to feed myself and the government gives me money for food and of course the government will take the money from other people who are productive and give it to me even though I have no job. It just does not make any sense when you look at it in that realm. So, you know, I mentioned these things just as an idea to kind of open up the mind just to kind of see a difference between, like I said in my college paper about, oh, everybody wants to retire. And then when you come to realize that, hey, you know what, that's a very Americanized idea. And that's another thing you learn in that class too is that America is not, you know, I'm not just an American, because if you go to South America, if you go into Brazil and you ask them, hey, what are you? They'll say, I'm American, because they're from South America, right? They don't consider themselves South American. I don't consider myself North American. We consider ourselves American. That's our shortened term for it. So to say American really only specifies the western half of the world, right? North America and South America. Okay, I've narrowed it down. So really, I should be calling myself the United Statesian or, you know, something else. But that's another thing that I learned in that class, too, is that, you know, it's a shift of mind thinking about different cultures, because you grow up calling yourself American. Everybody in the United States calls themselves American. And then it's not until you find out from other cultures, you either visit or you study them, that you find out, hey, this culture in South America, they all call themselves American too. But they are vastly different than I am. And in some cultures, of course, they don't believe in retirement. Most cultures, I should say, they don't believe in retirement. They don't believe in, I've worked so hard my entire life, I now get to sit around all day. Don't get me wrong. It's a beautiful life. I wish I could retire right now. I wish I could have so much money that I could just sit at home and write and watch movies and philosophize and all those things. But I don't have that money, so I have to focus on earning money right now. And, of course, I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting that lifestyle. I don't think there's anything wrong with it at all. But in order to think that that's what everybody in the world wants, that's what's wrong. In order to think that's what everybody in the world is seeking, that their goal is to be retired, is wrong. Because another flip side of me says, you know, if I'm sitting at home all day long and I'm not doing something I enjoy, I'm going to get bored very easily. And the flip side is, if I have a job where I don't think of it as work, if I'm creating something that creates money for me and I don't consider it work, then I'm no longer working. I am basically a working retired person, whatever you want to call it. I don't consider myself working. I consider it that I'm just being productive. I'm getting reimbursed for it, or I'm getting funds for it, you know, compensated, that's the word. I'm getting compensated for my great ideas, for my service, for my product, whatever. And I could go till I'm 90 years old. If I'm still of sound mind, I could go till I die, you know, and I would be completely happy with that. Nothing wrong with that. You know, I don't care if I was making $1 million a year. I wouldn't necessarily have to say, hey, I got to retire because I'm done with all this. I'd like to have that opportunity or the chance or the choice to do so. But it doesn't mean that as soon as I do something, and that's something that I think a lot of people kind of mistake, is when you see somebody who's making, for instance, Brett Favre, making tens of millions of dollars a year playing football, he gets hurt, he gets banged up, he retires, he comes back. People keep saying, oh, why do you keep coming back to football? Why don't you just stay retired? And I think it is twofold. I mean, first of all, yeah, he loves the game, of course. He wouldn't be coming back if he didn't love the game. But secondly, I mean, from my point of view, especially if you love the game a lot and then you're also thinking about it, hey, if I just work one more year, I can get $10 million. I mean, think about it. Imagine I give you $10 million and then I say, if you want to work next year, I'll give you another $10 million. You know, whatever you do, you're great at whatever you do, it's worth $10 million. What do you say? You're not going to say, well, I got $10 million, I'm retiring now. You're probably going to say, I got $10 million, but hey, that's another $10 million for one more year's worth of work. Are you kidding me? And of course, they might tell you, well, it's going to be really hard work. You know, you have to work 60-hour weeks or whatever. You know, I mean, something the equivalent of football. You know, instead of getting physically banged up, you'll just be physically at the office a long time. Whatever. You know, it's not going to be something that anybody can handle, but you're going to make $10 million if you do it. How many of us are going to say, oh, no, I don't want the $10 million? If you're smart, you take the $10 million, even if it only lasts a year. Now you got $20 million for a year's worth of work because you got $10 million up front and you got another $10 million. You got $20 million in 1 year. Now you can retire if you want, or if the guy extends your contract, gives you another $10 million, shoot, let's do it again. Or, of course, you can go that 1 year, see how you like it, and decide whether you want to go again. Anyway, I said I was going to wrap it up, so I better wrap it up. A lot of stuff to chew on, I know, but yeah, I think I'll just end it. I don't want to keep rambling on and on, so we'll end it for now, and we'll pick up another time. Peace out.